so the audio and video will be posted. However, we're having a challenge trying to take the very wide bandwidth recording we did and making it small enough that people can actually look at it on their computers without having, you know, the bunching up problem. So they're still working on that, but as I understand it, it will be posted imminently, probably tomorrow. So if you want to know, just call our office. They'll be able to tell you when it'll be posted. And we're going to leave it up there as a permanent archive. So what was really a thrill for me, by the way, it was a whole lot more than the 100 or 200 that were online, because in many places you actually had 25 to 40 people sitting in one place watching it. And the questions are really pouring in. And what I heard is that, you know, we were alternating, taking a question live from the audience with one from the web, but the web questions really piled up. But, you know, it was really fun. Our volunteer apologists, who were also participating, jumped in and answered all those questions for me. And so there was a lot more going on online than was taking place right here in this room or over in Pritchard Hall. And apparently they did really well answering the questions, so... I'm pleased that's not going to prove a bottleneck, because that was something wondering about. What's going to happen when we get 1,000 people participating online? Well, hey, if we got 30 or 40 volunteer apologists, we can take care of that.
So
just do an 8-hour skeptic forum. Well, I'd rather keep it at 2 and let our people, because you know what? The people who answer those questions really had fun answering the questions. And I'd hate to take that joy away from them. So,
when did they do that? When were they the next day? They answered.
No, they were answering them live.
Right then.
Yeah, because they could tell that they were piling up, and I wasn't going to get to them.
Oh.
So they just jumped in and started answering them while I was answering other questions. So that was really cool. So, any of you know what day this is today?
July.
It's July 1st.
Sunday.
And it's a special holiday, right?
Canada Day.
It's Canada Day, that's right. And I just got this wonderful little cartoon here, and it shows a couple of Canadians. And what it says here is, please accept my mildest excitement on this Canada Day. It's because Canadians have a reputation for being mild-mannered, but actually that's a misnomer. You know, people say, well, how come Canadians don't use fireworks on their Independence Day? Well, it doesn't get dark on July 1st in Canada. So that's why they don't do it. Instead, they save their fireworks for Halloween, because then they got a nice long dark night and they can do that. But there's another reason why their July 1st is so mild-mannered. It's the first month in many places where they don't have snow. And so it's a great chance to actually go outdoors. So they basically vacate the cities. And I saw that growing up in Canada. Come July 1st, hardly anybody was in the cities. They all went out into the countryside. And, you know, Canada's basically a giant park, so that's where they headed. So as little celebrating as possible, want to take advantage of that 1 month where they don't have snow. It's not really that bad. But I'll tell you, the observatory I used in Ontario, we had snow 11 months of the year. July was the only month that we didn't have snow. So, why waste July 1st? Okay.
What's the name of the observatory?
The Algonquin Radio Observatory. And there were a few years where it didn't snow in August, but I saw snow every month except July.
So. I never knew. I know Algonquin Park and stuff, but I never knew about the...
Well, they purposely put it in the park because they wanted to be isolated from radio interference. And so... But you know, it was interesting too. I remember when I was doing radio astronomy there, and hunting season would open up, but the park was protected. And those animals knew exactly where the boundary was. What you would see would be these deer and elk and moose creeping up to the line and kind of taunting all the hunters waiting for to cross that line. So it's kind of fun to watch. You know, animals, you know, they have a way of interacting with us. So, you know, I know what you can do. You can't shoot me when I go across that line. So we're talking about Einstein. You know, he really wasn't the first to discover the expanded universe. Anybody know who was the first one to acknowledge an expanded universe?
Galileo.
Yeah, Job. You got it right. It's Job. He was the first. Not Galileo, but it was Job, quickly followed by Moses, and David, and Jeremiah, Isaiah, Zechariah. They all talked about the continuously expanding universe. And until the 20th century, the Bible stood alone and predicting that we do indeed live in a universe that expands from a creation event, an actual space-time beginning. And I mention that because that was a big factor in my coming to faith in Christ. I wasn't raised in a Christian home, and picking up a Bible and seeing that its cosmology was right, and moreover that it was unique, alone in talking about a space-time beginning, continuous expansion, and constant laws of physics. So that was a big factor in my signing my name in the back of a Gideon Bible, committing my life to Christ 8 years before I actually ran into Christians, which actually happened at Caltech. So in the astronomy research group at Caltech that I met Christians, and they told me how to find a church. That was interesting. I remember meeting Dave Rogstad and says, this isn't like Canada. In Canada, you got to drive 50 to 100 miles to find a good church. I said, in Pasadena alone, there's 6 outstanding churches. So I said, well, give me a list. And I checked out those 6 churches, and I wound up here. So I don't know how I got here. That's how I got here. Okay.
Sierra Madre has, I think, 5 or 6 churches for 10,000 people.
It does, but I remember back in the mid-1970s that this was a church that, where things were really happening. People were teaching the Word of God. I noticed the church was filled with scientists and engineers, and what particularly attracted me, I walked into this church the very first Sunday I attended, and there was a guy in a 3-piece suit sharing a hymnal with a guy in a dirty white t-shirt, bare feet, long hair, and I figured the only thing that could actually make these two people friends would be their common relationship in Jesus Christ. And then I listened to the sermon and said, hey, the Bible's really being taught here. And people actually believe the Bible is true. This is a place I want to attend. So, and then 7 months later, this class got started. So, I want to know how that all happened. It goes back that far. Hey, I got a discovery I want to talk to you about. And it's actually a follow-up on one we mentioned, 2 years ago. And it has to do with mice and rats, but especially mice. And what they've found is an unusual drug that exists in the soil of Easter Island. So one place where they found this chemical, and it's a chemical called rapamycin. And they've been feeding it to mice, and feeding it to mice that are old and are showing signs of dementia. And what they discover is if they give these mice a steady diet of rapamycin from the soil of Easter Island, that it actually helps them learn better and it restores their memory. So, of course, people are getting excited thinking, you know, this might have applications for humans. And what we notice about mice and rats, of all the mammals that share the planet with us, they're the only ones that have the identical chemical pathways that govern memory with respect to what we human beings have. You don't see it in the apes. You don't see it in the chimpanzees or cows or sheep or pigs, but it's mice and rats that have virtually the identical chemical pathways that govern especially long-term memory. And so we're actually able to use these mice and rats to begin to develop cures for Alzheimer's, dementia, and conditions like dyslexia. They're actually thinking it might be applications for younger people. However, it does have side effects because they fed it to healthy mice, and what they're noticing is something that we notice in a similar drug that they discovered a couple of years ago. It works great if you give it to mice that actually have a problem with memory. It doesn't work so well where you give it to mice that don't have a problem with memory. And so what they discovered is it lowers their anxiety level, and it lowers their depressive behavior. And so if the mouse is depressed and anxious, this is a good drug to give it. But if it's a normal mouse, it doesn't make them anxious enough. And a little bit of anxiety in your life is good. A little bit of depression in your life is good. in terms of being able to react to circumstances, because if you think everything's rosy all the time, you'll ignore problems, forget to change oil in your car, things like that, forget to your wife's anniversary, and that could have drastic consequences, or her birthday. So, and having a lower anxiety, I mean, that could also make for interesting marital issues. They're saying, you know, before we use this on adults, we need to understand the side effects. And what's interesting is these studies on rats and mice were done with the idea of developing, you know, cures or at least therapy for, you know, old age dementia, with the understanding that, you know, we human bodies have crippled designs, and that we scientists can actually make a better human being than what we see around us. And what they discovered is that, no, we really are looking at humans that are optimally designed. It's that there are design trade-offs. So it's something similar to a drug that was discovered a couple of years ago. Well, actually, this one just goes back a few months. They found another protein, or this is not a drug, but a protein called CBP. Don't ask me what that stands for. It's very hard to pronounce. I'm not that good. If Fuzz was here, he could really roll it off his tongue. In fact, people at our office think that Fuzz speaks in tongues, but no, he's just a biochemist. So, but this CBT has been very effective with mice showing the signs of Alzheimer's. It seems to because what's happening with Alzheimer's is the synapses don't work and aren't able to connect two neurons that are related or holding the same information and allowing you to make the connection. And this CBP actually restores the synapse function and gets neurons talking to one another again. And what's really interesting is that they deliver to the mice with a virus. I mean, you just can't give the mouse an injection. It doesn't do any good. What you need is a virus that brings it in to the right part of the brain, basically infects the brain with this protein and restores the function of that part of the brain, the hippocampus part. So, but yeah, it shows you that, you know, viruses are good. It's a neutral virus, doesn't harm the human being in any way, but is able to deliver the drug to the right part of the brain. So yeah, when you celebrate Thanksgiving in November, you might want to thank God for the viruses, because without certain viruses. And by the way, the vast majority of viruses are neutral. Many are beneficial, and there's only a few that are deleterious. I mean, we focus all of our attention on the ones that make us sick, but the truth is the vast majority of viruses don't fall into that category. And without viruses, we wouldn't have adequate rainfall. Turns out that viruses actually help seed the clouds and cause rain to fall. So again, come Thanksgiving, you might want to thank God for the viruses providing the rain so that you can grow the food, so that you can have your vegetables when you're eating your Thanksgiving dinner. But also what they've been discovering is that there are side effects with these things. And, you know, I mentioned 2 years ago here, and this is also in our book, Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job, that 2 years ago they developed a study where they came up with 32 different species of mutated mice. And they were able to induce a mutation in a sick mouse, a mouse that had dementia or an Alzheimer's type symptom. And by inducing a mutation, they were able to get these mice that couldn't remember anything to suddenly remember things very well. And they could run mazes, and what they discovered is they actually do better than normal mice. And so it's kind of a super drug. It not only restores you to normal brain function, it actually gives you super brain function in the sense that you remember everything. But as they continued doing the studies, they discovered that there were consequences for the mice that, quote, remembered everything. Namely, that they could run a complex maze, much better than normal mice, but they could not run a simple maze. And the reason is that the mouse wasn't forgetting anything, and so it would pick up all the details and wind up storing irrelevant information, which would be probably quite important if the maze is very complex. But if it's simple, it causes the mouse to get disoriented because it's literally remembering too much. And it was this study that kind of led to a breakthrough that for normal human brain function, it's important that we be able to forget things. You want to be able to forget irrelevant things because they get in the way. And inability to forget also means that you're not able to think abstractly or metaphorically. But what I noticed in this latest study is they actually combined it with a survey of a random survey of college-educated people, asking them if they had ever taken, without prescription, one of these brain-enhancing drugs. And you know, probably the most common one would be Ritalin, which they use for attention deficit disorder. And what they discovered is 20% of the college-educated people admit to taking Ritalin before they have to, you know, cram for an exam. Because what it does is it helps you focus, helps you remember things. And so normal people who don't have a problem with attention deficit disorder are actually taking these drugs. But there are consequences. And so this is one thing to alarm. If 20% of the population is taking these drugs without their doctor's knowledge or without anybody else's knowledge, then what are the problems? Because if you start doing that with these tests, and what they discovered is normal people taking these drugs wind up coming out of the exam room being able to remember more than they should remember. And it begins to cause problems in their relationships. And once again, if we're relating to one another, you don't want to remember all the bad stuff you had with that individual 5 years ago, right? That can get in the way. So, and they wound up doing a study. I think there's actually a TV show where it's about a woman policeman who remembers everything. Okay, it's a rare condition. And it's actually led to some studies as a result of these mice and rats, because they had these mice and rats and they were giving these drugs administered either virally or through an injection. And there's now about a category of six different chemicals that work with mice to improve their memory, especially their long-term memory. But that led them to consider this very rare human condition. I think it's like 1 out of 100 million people will have this condition where their brains will remember literally everything. And so they led to a study of these individuals. Many of them become newspaper reporters. Why? Because when they're doing an interview, they don't have to take notes. They literally remember everything. 6 months later, they remember everything. In fact, what they notice is they could give, say, War and Peace to someone who had this condition. They read it once, and then they can recite it back to you. I mean, any book, they can do that.
I just had a good condition.
Well, you might think it's a good thing, especially if you're cramming for an exam, right, to be able to remember everything.
Yeah.
But what they discovered with these students that were basically taking attention deficit disorder drugs when they were actually normal, mm-hmm. is that when they got to that part of the exam where they, quote, had to interpret something rather than just simply coming back with information, they didn't perform as well as the students who didn't take the drug. And so evidently it affects your ability to think abstractly or emotionally or metaphorically. And so, yeah, you're great if you're doing a test that doesn't have anything on that. But often the professor will throw in something like that and then you're in trouble. But really what takes place is the long-term consequences. And what they're really discovering is our brains are like little computers in terms of the hardware. And you know what happens to your computer when it gets jammed with too much memory. Suddenly, it doesn't think as well. It begins to run a little more slowly. And it's holding too much in. And what you need to do is go into your computer and strip it of all that extraneous stuff, because you really don't want all of your memory to be used up, because then it's going to slow down other mental functions. You know, people have commented we only use 15% of our brain. That's a good thing. You don't want to clog it all up with useless phone numbers of people that you knew 25 years ago in a city across town or a city across the country. It's stuff that's probably a good idea just to eliminate. Then your brain can focus on other things. Yes?
I think they had about 5 or 6 of those people that could remember everything from way back when, you know, started really early age. They had it on TV not too long ago. I read a part of this.
My colleague's daughter was on that show, the, our the, the poor
orchestra conductor. His daughter was on that show, and she did say that it is a problem not to be able to forget things that happened in your childhood that you would like to forget. It is a problem to have to remember everything that ever happened.
Right. Well, the other thing they notice is that what accompanies these drugs, and also what happens to people who can't forget, is that they respond to fear and anxiety in a different way than the rest of the population. And so you become overly fearful because, quote, you know too much. And you begin to be looking at all these different risk factors, whereas the rest of us say, ah, that risk is not significant. I'll just forget about that and charge on your own way. And so what they're discovering, and some of these drugs actually make you too anxious. Some don't make you anxious enough. Some make you more fearful. Some make you less fearful. And that's one thing that's in common with all these drugs. All of them have that side effect. They either make you too fearful or too anxious or not fearful enough or anxious enough. And the truth is, life is filled with things that we should be paying attention to. You know, for example, a cobra that's 5 feet away all coiled up, you want to say, you know, that's dangerous, I'd better back up. On the other hand, you don't want to be getting very fearful just about the fact that there happens to be a spider crawling on a wall 20 feet away from you. I mean, you know, it's just a spider or it's just a fly. But people can respond in a way that actually inhibits their ability to live. Yes?
When you say you remember everything, do you literally mean 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks out of the year, every second of what you've done?
Well, these people can forget, but they have to work at it to forget things. In other words, they've actually interviewed these folks and said, do you remember everything? Well, I will unless I make a concerted effort to forget. But it becomes actually painful for them to try to forget things that they want to forget.
Well, that would drive you crazy, wouldn't it? It would burst, wouldn't it?
Typically, people have this syndrome lead their lives in such a way that there's very few human relationship issues they have to deal with. They love to work alone. That way they can avoid these things where it's going to cause problems. And then they try to get jobs where they just have to kind of remember rote things rather than having to do abstract thinking. So once they realize, hey, you know, I got a gift, but there's consequences that go with the gift too. And by the way, I think that's true of all of us. We all have gifts and there are defects that go with the gifts or what you call side effects. So just simply appreciating that and making sure, well, you know, I better not get a job as a poet or a songwriter. Rather, what I need is a job where it's very digitally focused. Then you can do all right.
If you're working on a pill where everything's perfect, I'll volunteer.
Here's my point. What these researchers are discovering is it's crucial that we have sub-optimized designs. And especially for something as complicated as a human brain, you don't want the different components working perfectly, because if they work perfectly where you can't forget anything, then it cripples other functions that God intends the brain to be able to accomplish. And so what you want are suboptimal designs. Let me give you an example. Many of you probably came here in an automobile. You could actually buy an automobile that gets 80 miles to the gallon, but it's going to take about 3 minutes to accelerate from 0 to 60 miles per hour. And with a vehicle with that slow of a performance capability, the probability of you getting into a serious automobile accident is relatively high. And so what you do is you choose to have a little less fuel use efficiency, in order to get the performance so that you can have a safe drive in a city like Los Angeles. Now, there are always people at the extreme. Some people want a high-performance vehicle, and they're willing to tolerate 4 miles to the gallon. But it's a trade-off. You cannot buy an automobile that can perform like a Ferrari or a Lamborghini and get 60 miles per gallon. It's not going to happen. You've got to compromise. And typically, if you want air conditioning, air conditioning is going to affect your gas mileage. So when you buy an automobile, there's all these designs that could be made perfect, but you, the customer, choose to have a suboptimal design in all the different components of your automobile so that you can get an overall performance, because after all, your automobile has got to be able to perform in many different circumstances. All the more so the human brain. The human brain has got to be able to accomplish a wide range of highly complex functions. In order for that to work, it must be sub-optimized. And the other thing that's crucial here is the human brain is at the maximum size. You can't make it any bigger than what it is. It's already absorbing 35% of your body's blood flow. And if it were to absorb more than that, the brain would overheat and it would kill the body. And so realizing, number one, you can't make the brain any bigger than it is. Therefore, we have to do suboptimal designs. So, for example, we're the one species that's capable of doing tensor calculus and playing a piano concerto. No other animal species can do that. But in order for the Creator to give us that kind of capability, he had to cripple our sense of smell. Of all the mammals out there, we've got probably the worst sense of smell. But, you know, if you want to do tensor calculus, maybe you just aren't going to be able to smell things as well as the other animals do. And hey, you can always have a pet dog, and the dog will be able to smell things that you can't smell and kind of give you a warning. Yeah.
Yeah, I had read an article about this disorder, or whatever you want to call it, maybe it's a gift. And they listed a lot of famous people that had it. And Bill Clinton was one of them, which might kind of answer some questions. But there was a person they interviewed, and she said she remembers every day of her life, what she wore, what she ate.
Oh, my God.
Like, you know, who would want to do that?
Wow.
Are people constantly aware of everything that's happened to them, or do they have to put an effort to remember?
They don't have to put any effort to remember at all. What they do have to exert a lot of effort is forgetting things that they want to forget. And so just like we work hard to remember things, they have to work really hard to forget things.
So at any time they know everything that's happened to them?
Well, for example, you could interview them 4 hours afterwards and they would know what everybody was wearing here in the class. What colors they were, check patterns and your hairstyles. Who was wearing glasses, who wasn't. They would know all that. Whereas the rest of us walk out and say, you know, that's not important to remember. So, yes.
If I remember correctly from the study, obviously the people that have this quote-unquote gift, obviously that one of the more difficult things they have was it's more difficult to do simple routine tasks. People typically have difficulty to wake up in the morning, get ready for work, and get out the door on time. The routine task of life is difficult. They have to have somebody to assist them.
Right.
Make sure that they actually eat breakfast, put on clean clothes, and get out the door on time. They usually have to have an assistant to help them because this gift hinders that routine.
What's something that they saw in all the mice is that they could do complex tasks but not simple tasks. As you point out, getting out of bed in the morning and getting to work on time, that's a simple task that's extremely difficult for these people to perform. And you're right, they need someone who has a normal neurological situation of the brain to actually help them get dressed and help them watch the clock and get to the office on time. And bottom line is they better get a job that works well with their, quote, gift / handicap. Okay, in the back, Ruth.
Can this be a form of autism?
There are autistic people who can remember certain things. The thing about this syndrome is they literally remember everything. But people on the autistic spectrum, and by the way, there's everybody on the autistic spectrum is different. But there are people, for example, who can remember the spoken word very well, but they can't remember anything visual. And that's typical of most people with autistic syndrome. I think it's like 4 to 5 who are on the spectrum are what you would call highly verbal and able to remember spoken things, but not so good at the visual. There are others that are at the other end where they can't remember the spoken word, but they can remember stuff they read and can actually remember patterns. And, you know, people who can pick up a book and a year later, they not only what was in the book, they can tell you where on the page that item was. So, but each one's different.
I've got a question to ask.
Sure.
I knew someone, one of the persons I know who lives at Prime, he said he remembered a man who could play music but couldn't talk.
Well, that's true. Then, you know, they call these savants. For example, there are people, I met one on Klein, who had amazing number skill abilities.
That's Randy Hughes.
Yeah, I mean, you know. he knew the calendar backwards and forward, going back 100 years. Rest of us look at that and say, that's not necessary information, but this individual had an incredible gift. You know, given any day of the week, any day of the year, back 50 years, he could tell you what day of the week it was and what happened on that day. Yes.
Since our brain is an electrochemical organ, what happens, and it runs on a few millivolts, what happens to the increase of voltage? If it's 30 millivolts, say 100 millivolts, what will happen to the brain?
It's not good. I mean,
have they ever done that?
Oh yeah, they've done those kinds of experiments. In fact, that's how they used to deal with people that were mentally ill. People that are severely mentally ill 100 years ago, hey, even 50 years ago, they would give them what was called electroshock therapy.
That's right.
And what it basically does is it cripples those parts of the brain that make you highly anxious. But now that part of the brain no longer functions like it should. And so today, it's extremely rare that they use any kind of electroshock therapy. But it used to be done quite routinely. In fact, I had an aunt that had that done to her. You know, a brilliant woman, extremely high IQ, but suffered from serious mental illness. And they couldn't treat it because they didn't have the appropriate therapy back 50 years ago, and so they gave her electroshock. Her IQ plummeted, but her anxiety was gone. But the problem is she doesn't have enough anxiety. You know, great gal, I've always loved her, but I kind of preferred her the way she was. And you know, now there's other ways we can deal with anxiety, but that's how they used to take care of it. So yeah, you can increase the voltage, increase the amperage, but basically you're doing damage to the brain. Okay, hey, tell you what, let's actually make some progress here on our Psalm 139 in Human Origins. And I will have to leave a few minutes early because I got a 9-hour drive with my wife coming up after this class. So I'm going to have Dave come up here and close us in prayer, and I'm going to exit out of here. But let's jump into this. Okay. We've been discussing some of the challenges on the theological debate about human origins. And you know, we spent a couple of weeks looking at different animal models as to whether or not there's actually genetic evidence that the human species is descended from two people or thousands of people or maybe 10,000 people, and how when we do field work on different mammal species, we discover that those that take significant time to develop, that is to go from birth to being able to be fully adult and reproduce, that we discover that the genetic diversity gives us no clue as to the ancestral population. And these are experiments where we actually know what the ancestral population is, such as with the Mouflon sheep, where they took a male and a female. They knew the genetic makeup of the male and female. They knew they were highly inbred, put them on this island all by themselves, came back decades later when there had been many generations of Mouflon sheep, sampled the DNA, and was far more diverse than what any of the genetic models have predicted. And this has been done in three different species, the Przewalski horse, orangutans, and these Mouflon sheep. And in each case, it shows that the genetic models, the mathematical models, used to predict an ancestral population don't work. You actually wind up with a much larger ancestral population than what the actual field evidence would indicate. And since we human beings take the longest time to develop, literally 23, 24 years, the anticipation is that sampling the diversity of human DNA in the world today is not going to be a useful tool for coming up with an ancestral population. And that's been one of the primary challenges of the biblical creation model. People said it's impossible that all humanity can be descended from one man and one woman, because these genetic models tell us that given the diversity of human genetic DNA, that we must be descended from anywhere from 1,200 to 10,000 individuals. But these animal models tell us that you're always going to get an inflated number. And what is interesting is over the past 30 years, the number based on our best genetic models have been getting smaller and smaller. And so where they used to say we were descended from several million human beings. In Francis Collins' book, The Language of God, he said 10,000. And in Fuzz Rana's latest debate with Dennis Venema, he said 1,200. The numbers were heading down in the biblical direction. So it's certainly too soon to say that we have to reinterpret the book of Romans, which is really what's happening in many theistic evolutionary camps, saying that genetic evidence is so strong that we have to abandon our traditional interpretation of Romans chapter 5 and Genesis 3, the texts that tell us we're descended from one man and one woman. And by the way, this is something that Fuzz brought up in his debate. Who says that the original couple has ingrown DNA? I mean, you know, God did take a biopsy from Adam's side, but we don't know the degree to which he re-engineered that DNA to make the woman. And if the woman's DNA was very diverse compared to Adam's DNA, then again, these models are irrelevant. Because these models, we're actually talking about animals, pairs, that are already highly ingrown with respect to their DNA. So you get a very different result if indeed the original couple has very diverse DNA with respect to one another. This chromosome 2 is a second argument that you'll see in books such as The Language of God, where they claim that we human beings must be naturally descended from a common ancestor with the chimpanzees. Because what they're pointing out here is that the great apes have 24 chromosome pairs. So that would be the orangutans, the gorillas, chimpanzees. They have 24 chromosome pairs. We human beings are different. We only have 23. But what they've been pointing out is when you compare the chimpanzee chromosomes with the human chromosomes, it appears that what happened is that two of the chimpanzee chromosomes fused and became one. So they're claiming that this is evidence that we and the chimpanzees have a common ancestor by natural descent. And this is something that Fuzz took up in our book, Who is Adam? And I think we've got, no, we don't have the books out there, but we'll have them next week. Where he pointed out that if you actually look at what appears to be a fused chromosome, is that the telomeres and the centromeres, the blue blocks there are just kind of a pictorial representation, because every chromosome has got a little chunk called the centromere in the middle, and the ends, they have telomeres, which are basically aglets. You know, if you have a shoelace, you got this little plastic thing at the end of the string that's designed to keep it from unraveling. Well, the same thing's true of our chromosomes. The chromosome has little aglets at either end that we call the telomeres. And what you see in this, one of the chromosome, the human chromosome 2, is it looks like two ape chromosomes got fused together. But as Fuzz points out, when you actually look at the chemistry of the this thing right here, the apparently two fused telomeres and the centromere here, these are normal. So they, at the very end, you see what look like normal telomeres, which you see here what they call telomere-like features. Not exactly like a telomere, but it's got hints of what a telomere would look like. And so Fuzz's point is to say that their actual telomeres is overstretching the actual chemical analysis here. Same thing for the centromeres. And therefore, this may not be a fused chromosome, although Fuzz is willing to admit that it really could be a fused chromosome. But he says if it is a fused chromosome, it doesn't quite look like it should. But he says, suppose that it is. What we notice is that we do see in the human population and the ape population mutation events where chromosomes get fused together or chromosomes get split. So, for example, you see this happening with Down syndrome. It's a chromosome feature. But we notice is either it kills the individual, which is the most common feature, or the individual becomes severely handicapped. There's not a single instance where there's been a fusion event where it actually led to, quote, a good outcome or an improved outcome. And so Fuzz's point is, if this really is a fused chromosome, then this is God that did the fusion. to make sure it was just right so it wouldn't kill or lead to deleterious effects. If it's natural, there's going to be deleterious consequences. By the way, when we've dialogued with BioLogos, with Dennis Venema, with Francis Collins, and Daryl Falk, they all did admit in our dialogues with them that yes, indeed, what you do see in natural fusion events are catastrophic consequences. But they said, this looks like it could be a fusion event. And our point is, well, it tells us in Genesis 2 that God did take DNA from Adam, looks like that, took something from Adam's side that would include DNA, and that's a possible way that God could create. So it says we're not saying that God can't take a DNA sample from a chimpanzee and re-engineer it. We're just saying it's not going to happen naturalistically. It's going to take an intelligent being who knows which parts to include, which parts not to include, and actually redesign it in such a way that it works as best as possible. And so this may not be a fusion event because what we see are remnants of what like to be the aglets, the telomeres, and the centromeres. They may not be real. And moreover, when you actually compare chromosome 2 to the function of the relevant chromosomes in the chimpanzee, it's not the same. But that could be evidence that God took that and re-engineered it. And so there's two ways that God can create a new species that we see in Genesis 2. What did he do with Adam? He took the dust from the ground and basically made Adam from scratch, from the materials that are in the dust of the ground. But a second way he can do it is the way he did with Eve. You take an already existing creature and take a sample from that creature. We all have DNA. That's something that all life shares in common. And take that and re-engineer it. And so the whole point is, which way would God do it? Fuzz's comment is, God made us in the image of God. And what we notice is that designs we find inside the cell are uncannily similar to the designs that we human beings come up with. So, for example, you can find motors inside the cellular machinery of a cell that looks identical to rotary engines, looks identical to the piston engines. They found one, for example, that looks like a three-piston engine with a flywheel, drive shaft, the whole bit, piston chambers. The only difference is it works a lot better than our piston engines. This one in particular runs with 75% efficiency instead of the maximum 25% that you would have in your automobile. And even ratchet motors that we see inside the cell. And so Fuzz's point is, well, how would we, who are intelligent, go about taking a creature and coming up with something that's brand new? What would be the most efficient way to come up with a brand new species? Should we take a template and rebuild it, or should we make it from scratch? And Fuzz's answer to that is, I don't know. It's so complicated in terms of what these different species of life are like and what the differences are. His feeling is that in some cases, the most efficient design pathway would be to take the dust of the earth. In other places, it would be to take a template, or maybe a combination of the two. But it is true that if you look at life all over the planet, our DNA is amazingly similar. And it's actually a good thing for DNA being amazingly similar, just what we were talking about with the mice. Because their DNA is so similar to our human DNA, we're actually able to use those mice for medical advances. And isn't it interesting that where we have the greatest DNA similarity with other species of life, especially the mammals, we have the greatest similarity where it has the greatest opportunity for medical research. So, for example, our DNA is virtually identical to chimpanzee and orangutan and gorilla and baboon DNA when it comes to the structure of our kidneys and our liver and our heart. And which means we can actually use these animals to transplant organs from them and put them in human beings. That wouldn't be the case unless the DNA actually governs those organs was virtually identical to our DNA. Now, why would God do that, say, for a chimpanzee and not for a mouse? Well, you're not going to be able to transplant a kidney out of a mouse and put it into a human being and be able to do much. But, you take a kidney out of a chimpanzee, it's about the same size, same functionality, same level of capacity to work as you would get with a human being. And so you want the similarity to be there for the great apes. And likewise for the mice and rats, it's great that their DNA is so similar as it governs chemical pathways for memory, because with mice, they're little, they're small, they're easy to raise. And by the way, it's interesting reading these articles, how they test for anxiety. What they do is they pick up a mouse by its tail. Mice don't like to be picked up by the tail. And then they drop them into a pool of water. Mice hate water. Okay, that instantly generates anxiety. And they watch the behavior of the mouse. Now try doing that with a chimpanzee. You've got problems. So, and therefore what we notice is that it really does seem like God has designed DNA similarity where it really counts in terms of developing medical advances for human beings. Yes.
You said that the Adam came from dust.
Yes.
God created Adam from the dust. Where does the DNA or the chromosomes come from for the dust?
Well, inside that dust is carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, phosphorus, and you can literally build the amino acids and the nucleotides and the sugars from scratch. So, in dirt is everything you need to make ribose. But it's going to take someone who's quite intelligent, sophisticated, with a lot of power, to take those chemicals in the dust and make the ribose. But God could do that. Another thing he could do is, actually take something he's already designed and say, let me re-engineer what I've already designed.
So what they mean when they say dust at a funeral, from dust to dust?
We really do come from the dust, even though we come from our mother. The mother eats stuff that comes from the dust, and the stuff she eats goes to make your body, and when you die, it all decays and goes back to the soil. So it means that. But in the case of Adam, he really was made from the dust of the earth, made from scratch. And again, Fuzz's point is, take the way we manufacture things. Sometimes taking a template, you're wanting to make something that's so radically different that you don't want to use a template. And that's the thing about human beings. Our brain structure is so radically different, for example, from all other species, that it's almost pointless to take a DNA template. You're better off doing it from scratch. But once you've got that first man, it's not that difficult to use a template to make a woman, because you've already done all the design engineering already. And so Fuzz's whole point is, the Creator is going to kind of do it the way we do it. We're created in the image of God. He's going to design by the most efficient pathway possible. And that's one thing we notice, both in the Bible and the record of nature. God designs by the most efficient means possible. He doesn't waste his miraculous power. So once he's made Adam, why make Eve from the dust of the earth when you already got this great template you can use and do a little bit of re-engineering, and you're all done.
Template? Is that sort of like the computer program type?
What I mean by a template is take the chassis of a car.
Oh.
You could use that chassis to make many different models.
Oh, I see.
Just put different bodies on them. Okay, last question, then I got to wrap up.
If we're made in the image of God, he's got all that. He just looks at himself and just says, this is the way we're going to do it.
Now, here's the distinction. Okay. Hebrews 1. Jesus Christ is the exact representation of God. The rest of us are only images of God. In other words, we share some features. We are body, soul, and spirit like God is. We are creative like God is. And so we share some of the features, but only Jesus Christ has all the features of the Godhead in bodily form. We don't have that. We have some, but not all. With that, I'm going to have Dave here close us in prayer. Thank you.
We have a little bit of time. I'm actually going to pick this up, Hugh, because that God took a biopsy from Adam's Eve's side and made Eve. And then you said he could have changed the DNA. And actually, we know that. I have a good friend of mine who's a doctor, a pediatrician. And I had heard, obviously, somebody say that one of the reasons women fainted more often is they actually have less red blood cells than men. And so I asked him if that was true. And he said, oh, yeah. He says, not only is that true, he says, us in the medical profession, one of the things that obviously we're kind of muzzled on is how science has discovered that women's bodies and their DNA is radically different than men. And he said, but we're not allowed to talk about it because it's politically incorrect, and we would probably lose our job if we came out and talked about all the scientific discoveries that we've made and the difference between men and women. He says he had a friend of his who is a doctor that works on bones?
What?
Right, exactly. And he said that obviously if you are one of those doctors, you could pick up a woman, see a skeleton, and every single bone in the body is different between a man and a woman, that they can find out, even if there's just a fingertip. If you're an expert, you can look at that fingertip and say whether that's a man or a woman. Their body is absolutely, totally radically different. Again, their blood is different. The women have less red blood cells. Men have more red blood cells. The hormones, of course, we know are all different. They do talk about that. The latest discovery, of course, is looking at the brains, that a woman's brain and a man's brain, of course, are totally different. Totally thinking different. Women, well, obviously, the joke, obviously, is that men's brains are damaged. That women's brain, their left right side of their brain and their right side of the brain is able to communicate, so they have a lot more neuron connections between the two sides of their brain, which is why, say, my wife, I noticed that when we had children, that she could be in the kitchen cooking and looking at a recipe sheet, you know, and measuring things or whatever, and she would hear, you know, my two sons over in the other side of the house fighting or arguing and one crying, and she could hear that while she's cooking and thinking, and turn to me and say, you know, would you go please rescue, you know, little Tom, you know? Me, I'm obviously on my computer writing an email. I did not hear the conversation at all. When she said that, all of a sudden I hear him crying, you know, and everything else and stuff, but I was so into my email, I cannot do that. So women are much better at multitasking than men by far, you know. It doesn't mean that men can't multitask, but for an average, we're talking about all average, a woman can multitask a lot better than a guy, which is why men have a difficult time following their conversations, you know, that a woman's, you know, just to listen to women talk, you know, they're going here and here, and you're like, well, what's the bottom line, you know, and they just follow around. And some people call that spider webbing or whatever, whereas a guy, his brain is designed to focus on one item and then to find a goal and a solution to fix that item, you know, and that's where we're at. So we're always like, you know, we're telling her, you know, get to the bottom line, what am I supposed to fix for you? And of course, a lot of times, obviously, the woman doesn't want to be fixed, you know, or the problem solved. She wants to know, do you care, you know? And so their brain is just totally, totally different, obviously, in that regard. Their blood is different. I mean, basically, also, the woman's body is completely designed, of course, for reproduction. You know, the reason their bones are different is for reproduction. Their hormones are different for reproduction. And so the woman's body is all designed around reproduction in that regard. On the flip side, because of the men, obviously, having higher levels of adrenaline, higher blood levels, obviously, you know, we're designed for strength and for conquering and focus on a problem, obviously. I mean, I've obviously seen that. Obviously, I'm an electronic engineer, and I'd be trying to solve electronic problem, and I had a soldering iron that runs at about maybe 800 degrees, and I had just, you had talked about, he had a friend that did that too one time. I was so focused on fixing this problem, I put my hand down on my desk, and I smell, you know, something burning, you know, and I'm like, I wonder what's burning. I looked down, and of course, it was the soldering iron on my arm that was burning, and I was so focused on trying to fix and solve this problem that I was working on for my company that obviously I did not feel the pain until I smelled my burnt skin and my nose. So that's how focused the guy can do. And of course, we have lots of stories of valor on that, people that were shot in battle, and the guy is so focused on getting the enemy and stuff, you know, that until things settle down, he doesn't look down and realize, oh my gosh, I'm shot, I'm bleeding dead. A woman could not do that. You know, their brain is not designed that way because they multitask, they're aware of their whole body, their surroundings more, where the guys can just really focus. So women, and that obviously brings up the whole mystery. I said, well, is there any theory, obviously, you went to medical school, is there any theory about how sexes came apart? Because obviously the lower animals are basically one sex, right? Non-sex, and it's a radical evolutionary step. You haven't even talked about this class. Even Fuzz doesn't talk about it a lot. To sit there and say, okay, you have these animals that are not male or female, and then you have males and females showing up at the scene at the Cambrian explosion. And there is no evolutionary model to figure out how you can sit there and go from a life form that has no sex to have two sexes And of course, once again, those two sexes, whether it be horseshoe crabs that have been around for 500 million years, there is no evolution model that those two horseshoe crabs again are radically different, because the one body is designed for reproduction, the other one is designed for strength, for territorial and things like that. And there's no evolutionary pathway, and so you have an explosion of actually having no sex animals, and then poof, you've got this radical, huge, the fish, all these mollusks, all these animals that have two sexes, and there's no evolutionary pathway to explain that. So when Hugh said, he took off the biopsy, and said, well, God could have modified it, the answer is no. He did modify it radically different, obviously, because obviously when he took that biopsy, he made a being that was totally geared towards nurturing, and reproduction. So that's something the woman can do also, can nurture a lot better than a guy can, obviously, because they're able to multitask, things like that. Or me, I would slip through the night, my kids would whimper, my wife would wake up and hear me sleep right through it. So thank God for women, because the kids would be, not as good if they didn't have moms to nurture them. And we know that now. We've done studies with the guys that have raised children. They don't have that nurture ability. They're lacking, obviously, that nurturing that women can give them. Yes? It is. And studies have done that. I've gone over and over again with studies. Obviously, the children that grow up with an intact household with a man and a woman, even if those men and women are having difficulty in their marriages, they're going to be better off if they're just raised with one. Because the woman is going to nurture, but obviously the man needs to be there for discipline. And so both biologically and relationally, it's better to have both.
And I was thinking about just the design of two sexes.
The design also.
Talks about really reflects aspect of God.
It does. Very good. And that's the reason, obviously, that God uses marriage as an example, obviously, in the Bible. That we are the church is always referred to in the feminine, and the man is always referred to as the male. And why it talks about when we get into heaven, we're going to have the wedding feast of the Lamb. And so God obviously very much knows that. It is. My wife is standing there, which means it is exactly time to pray. And look forward to seeing you next week. I'm up here if you got more questions, obviously, to continue on that conversation. Dealer, we're very thankful for Hugh. We pray that he doesn't get stuck in any traffic or any problems at the airport, that he makes his flight. And as usual, we pray for divine appointments, Lord, for him on his trips. We know that you are already preparing the hearts and the minds of the people that he's going to talk to, that will hear that message, Lord. And we look for both reconciliation in people's lives and in churches. And most of all, that those that may not know you, Lord, may come into a personal relationship with you to know about the grace and the mercy offered through your Son, Jesus Christ. We're so very thankful, Lord, that you have named all of the stars. You know how many hairs are on each one of our heads. Even if one falls off, you still know how many hairs are on our heads. You know us personally, intimately, and that you love each one of us so deeply, and you created us each uniquely with gifts and talents and also weaknesses, Lord, that we may, through our lives, glorify you, Lord. Be with us this week. Amen.
Thank you.